seen it somewhere before. I sigh. Maybe he told Aunt Maggie. Maybe she got better directions.
Maybe, he says, and continues to stare at Uncle Jeb's squiggles.
She dragged me back in time to a much, much older memory, a memory that had escaped her for a long time. I was surprised to realize that she'd only put these memories, the old and the fresh, together recently, after I was here. That was why the lines had slipped through her careful control, despite the fact that they were one of the most precious of her secrets, because of the urgency of her discovery. In this blurry, early memory, Melanie sat in her father's lap with the same album, not so tattered then, open in her hands. Her hands were tiny, her fingers stubby. It was very strange to remember being a child in this body. They were on the first page.
"Do you remember where this is?"
Dad asks, pointing to the old gray picture at the top of the page. The paper looks thinner than the other photographs, as if it has worn down flatter and flatter and flatter since some great-great-grandpa took it. "It's where we Striders come from," I answer, repeating what I've been taught.
"Right. That's the old Strider Ranch. You went there once, but I bet you don't remember it. I think you were 18 months old."
Dad laughs.
"It's been Strider Land since the very beginning."
And then the memory of the picture itself. A picture she'd looked at 1,000 times without ever seeing it. It was black and white, faded to grays. A small, rustic wooden house far away on the other side of a desert field. In the foreground, a split-rail fence. A few equine shapes between the fence and the house. And then, behind it all, the sharp, familiar profile. There were words, a label scrawled in pencil across the top white border. "Strider Ranch, 1904, in the morning shadow of Picacho Peak," I said quietly. "He'll have figured it out, too, even if they never found Sharon. I know Jared will have put it together. He's smarter than me. And he has the picture. He probably saw the answer before I did. He could be so close." The thought had her so filled with yearning and excitement that the blank wall in my head slipped entirely. I saw the whole journey now. Saw her and Jared's and Jamie's careful trek across the country, always by night in their inconspicuous stolen vehicle. It took weeks. I saw where she'd left them in a wooded preserve outside the city. So different from the empty desert they were used to. The cold forest where Jared and Jamie would hide and wait had felt safer in some ways, because the branches were thick and concealing, unlike the spindly desert foliage that hid little, but also more dangerous in its unfamiliar smells and sounds. Then the separation, a memory so painful we skipped through it, flinching. Next came the abandoned building she'd hidden in, watching the house across the street for her chance. There, concealed within the walls or in the secret basement, she hoped to find Sharon. "I shouldn't have let you see that," Melanie thought. The faintness of her silent voice gave away her fatigue. The assault of memories, the persuasion and coercion had tired her. "You'll tell them where to find her. You'll kill her. Two. Yes, I mused aloud. I have to do my duty. Why, she murmured almost sleepily. What happiness will it bring you? I didn't want to argue with her, so I said nothing. The mountain loomed larger ahead of us. In moments we would be beneath it. I could see a little rest stop with a convenience store and a fast food restaurant bordered on one side by a flat, concrete space, a place for mobile homes. There were only a few in residence now, with the heat of the coming summer making things uncomfortable. What now? I wondered. Stop for a late lunch or an early dinner? Fill my gas tank and then continue on to Tucson in order to reveal my fresh discoveries to the seeker? The thought was so repellent that my jaw locked against the sudden heave of my empty stomach. I slammed on the brake reflexively, screeching to a stop in the middle of the lane. I was lucky. There were no cars to hit me from behind. There were also no drivers to stop and offer their help and concern. For this moment, the highway was empty. The sun beat down on the pavement, making it shimmer, disappear in places. This shouldn't have felt like a betrayal, the idea of continuing on my right and proper course. My first language, the true language of the soul that was spoken only on our planet of origin, had no word for betrayal, or traitor, or even loyalty, because without the existence of an opposite, the concept had no meaning. And yet I felt a deep well of guilt at the very idea of the seeker. It would be wrong to tell her what I knew. Wrong how? I countered my own thought viciously. If I stopped here and listened to the seductive suggestions of my host, I would truly be a traitor. That was impossible. I was a soul. And yet I knew what I wanted, more powerfully and vividly than anything I had ever wanted in all the 8 lives I'd lived. The image of Jared's face danced behind my eyelids when I blinked against the sun. Not Melanie's memory this time, but my memory of hers. She forced nothing on me now. I could barely feel her in my head as she waited. I imagined her holding her breath, as if that were possible, for me to make my decision. I could not separate myself from this body's wants. It was me, more than I'd ever intended it to be. Did I want, or did it want? Did that distinction even matter now? In my rearview mirror, the glint of the sun off a distant car caught my eye. I moved my foot to the accelerator, starting slowly toward the little store in the shadow of the peak. There was really only one thing to do. Chapter 10 Turned. The electric bell rang, announcing another visitor to the convenience store. I started guiltily and ducked my head behind the shelf of goods we were examining. "Stop acting like a criminal," Melanie advised. "I'm not acting," I replied tersely. The palms of my hands felt cold under a thin sheen of sweat, though the small room was quite hot. The wide windows let in too much sun for the loud and laboring air-conditioning unit to keep up. "Which one?" I demanded. "The bigger one," she told me. I grabbed the larger pack of the two available, a canvas sling that looked well able to hold more than I could carry. Then I walked around the corner to where the bottled water was shelved. "We can carry 3 gallons," she decided. "That gives us 3 days to find them." I took a deep breath, trying to tell myself that I wasn't going along with this. I was simply trying to get more coordinates from her, that was all. When I had the whole story, I would find someone, a different seeker, maybe one less repulsive than the one assigned to me, and pass the information along. I was just being thorough, I promised myself. My awkward attempt to lie to myself was so pathetic that Melanie didn't pay any attention to it, felt no worry at all. It must be too late for me, as the seeker had warned. Maybe I should have taken the shuttle. "Too late? I wish," Melanie grumbled. "I can't make you do anything you don't want to do. I can't even raise my hand." Her thought was a moan of frustration. I looked down at my hand, resting against my thigh rather than reaching for the water as she wanted to do so badly. I could feel her impatience, her almost desperate desire to be on the move, on the run again, just as if my existence were no more than a short interruption, a wasted season now behind her. She gave the mental equivalent of a snort at that, and then she was back to business. "Come on," she urged me. "Let's get going. It will be dark soon." With a sigh, I pulled the largest, shrink-wrapped flat of water bottles from the shelf. It nearly hit the floor before I caught it against a lower shelf edge. My arms felt as though they'd popped halfway out of their sockets. "You're kidding me," I exclaimed aloud.
"Shut up!" "Excuse me?"
A short, stooped man, the other customer, asked from the end of the aisle. "Nothing," I mumbled, not meeting his gaze. This is heavier than I expected.
Would you like some help? He offered.
No, no, I answered hastily. I'll just take a smaller one. He turned back to the selection of potato chips.
No, you will not, Melanie assured me. I've carried heavier loads than this. You've let us get all soft, wanderer, she added in irritation.
Sorry, I responded absently, bemused by the fact that she had used my name for the first time.
Lift with your legs.
I struggled with the flat of water, wondering how far I could possibly be expected to carry it. I managed to get it to the front register, at least. With great relief, I edged its weight onto the counter. I put the bag on top of the water, and then added a box of granola bars, a roll of donuts, and a bag of chips from the closest display.
Water is way more important than food in the desert, and we can only carry so much.
I'm hungry, I interrupted. And these are light.
It's your back, I guess, she said grudgingly. And then she ordered, get a map.
I placed the one she wanted, a topographical map of the county, on the counter with the rest. It was no more than a prop in her charade. The cashier, a white-haired man with a ready smile, scanned the barcodes.
Doing some hiking? He asked pleasantly.
The mountain is very beautiful.
The trailhead is just up that, he said, starting to gesture.
I'll find it, I promised quickly, pulling the heavy, badly balanced load back off the counter.
Head down before it gets dark, sweetie. You don't want to get lost.
I will.
Melanie was thinking sulphurous thoughts about the kind old man.
He was being nice. He's sincerely concerned about my welfare, I reminded her.
You're all very creepy, she told me acidly. Didn't anyone ever tell you not to talk to strangers?
I felt a deep tug of guilt as I answered. There are no strangers among my kind.
I can't get used to not paying for things, she said, changing the subject. What's the point of scanning them?
Inventory, of course. Is he supposed to remember everything we took when he needs to order more? Besides, what's the point of money when everyone is perfectly honest?
I paused, feeling the guilt again so strongly that it was an actual pain.
Everyone but me, of course.
Melanie shied away from my feelings, worried by the depth of them, worried that I might change my mind. Instead, she focused on her raging desire to be away from here, to be moving toward her objective. Her anxiety leaked through to me, and I walked faster. I carried the stack to the car and set it on the ground beside the passenger door.
Let me help you with that.
I jerked up to see the other man from the store, a plastic bag in his hand, standing beside me.
Thank you,
I finally managed, my pulse thudding behind my ears. We waited, Melanie tensed as if to run, while he lifted our acquisitions into the car.
There's nothing to fear. He's being kind, too.
She continued to watch him distrustfully.
Thank you, I said again as he shut the door.
My pleasure.
He walked off to his own vehicle without a backward glance at us. I climbed into my seat and grabbed the bag of potato chips. Look at the map, she said. Wait till he's out of sight.
No one is watching us, I promised her.
But with a sigh, I unfolded the map and ate with one hand. It was probably a good idea to have some sense of where we were headed.
Where are we headed? I asked her. We've found the starting point, so what now?
Look around, she commanded. If we can't see it here, we'll try the south side of the peak.
See what?
She placed the memorized image before me. A ragged, zigzagging line, four tight switchbacks, the fifth point strangely blunt, like it was broken. Now I saw it as I should. A jagged range of four pointed mountain peaks with the broken-looking fifth. I scanned the skyline, east to west across the northern horizon. It was so easy it felt false.
as though I'd made the image up only after seeing the mountain silhouette that created the northeast line of the horizon.
"That's it!"
Melanie almost sang in her excitement. "Let's go!" She wanted me to be out of the car, on my feet, moving. I shook my head, bending over the map again. The mountain ridge was so far in the distance I couldn't guess at the miles between us and it. There was no way I was walking out of this parking lot and into the empty desert unless I had no other option. "Let's be rational," I suggested, tracing my finger along a thin ribbon on the map, an unnamed road that connected to the freeway a few miles east and then continued in the general direction of the range. "Sure," she agreed complacently. "The faster the better." We found the unpaved road easily. It was just a pale scar of flat dirt through the sparse shrubbery, barely wide enough for one vehicle. I had a feeling that the road would be overgrown with lack of use in a different region, someplace with more vital vegetation, unlike the desert plants that needed decades to recover from such a violation. There was a rusted chain stretched across the entrance, screwed into a wooden post on one end, looped loosely around another post at the other. I moved quickly, pulling the chain free and piling it at the base of the first post, hurrying back to my running car, hoping no one would pass and stop to offer me help. The highway stayed clear as I drove onto the dirt and then rushed back to refasten the chain. We both relaxed when the pavement disappeared behind us. I was glad that there was apparently no one left I would have to lie to, whether with words or silence. Alone, I felt less of a renegade. Melanie was perfectly at home, here in the middle of nothing. She knew the names of all the spiny plants around us. She hummed their names to herself, greeting them like old friends.
Creosote, ocotillo, choya, prickly pear, mesquite.
Away from the highway, the trappings of civilization, the desert seemed to take on a new life for Melanie. Though she appreciated the speed of the jolting car, our vehicle didn't have the ground clearance necessary for this side trip, as the shocks reminded me with every pit in the dirt. She itched to be on her feet, loping through the safety of the baking desert. We would probably have to walk, and all too soon for my taste, but when that time came I doubted it would satisfy her. I could feel the real desire beneath the surface. Freedom. To move her body to the familiar rhythm of her long stride with only her will for guidance. For a moment I allowed myself to see the prison that was life without a body. To be carried inside, but unable to influence the shape around you. To be trapped. To have no choices. I shuddered and refocused on the rough road, trying to stave off the mingled pity and horror. No other host had made me feel such guilt for what I was. Of course, none of the others had stuck around to complain about the situation. The sun was close to the tips of the western hills when we had our first disagreement. The long shadows created strange patterns across the road, making it hard to avoid the rocks and craters.
"There it is!"
Melanie crowed as we caught sight of another formation farther east. A smooth wave of rock, interrupted by a sudden spur that swung a thin, long finger out against the sky. She was all for turning immediately into the brush, no matter what that did to the car. "Maybe we're supposed to go all the way to the first landmark," I pointed out. The little dirt road continued to wind in more or less the right direction, and I was terrified to leave it. How else would I find my way back to civilization? Wasn't I going back? I imagined the seeker right at this moment, as the sun touched the dark, zigzagging line of the western horizon. What would she think when I didn't arrive in Tucson? A spasm of glee made me laugh out loud. Melanie also enjoyed the picture of the seeker's furious irritation. How long would it take her to go back to San Diego to see if this had all been a ploy to get rid of her? And then what steps would she take when I wasn't there? When I wasn't anywhere. I just couldn't picture very clearly where
I would be at that point.
Look, a dry wash. It's wide enough for the car. Let's follow it, Melanie insisted.
I'm not sure we're supposed to go that way yet.
It will be dark soon and we'll have to stop. You're wasting time.
She was silently shouting in her frustration.
Or saving time, if I'm right. Besides, it's my time, isn't it?
She didn't answer in words. She seemed to stretch inside my mind, reaching back toward the convenient wash.
I'm the one doing this, so I'm doing it my way.
Melanie fumed wordlessly in response.
Why don't you show me the rest of the lines? I suggested. We could see if anything is visible before night falls.
No, she snapped. I'll do that part my way.
You're being childish.
Again, she refused to answer. I continued toward the four sharp peaks, and she sulked. When the sun disappeared behind the hills, night washed across the landscape abruptly. One minute the desert was sunset orange, and then it was black. I slowed, my hand fumbling around the dashboard, searching for the switch for the headlights.
Have you lost your mind? Melanie hissed. Do you have any idea how visible headlights would be out here? Someone is sure to see us.
So what do we do now?
Hope the seat reclines.
I let the engine idle as I tried to think of options besides sleeping in the car, surrounded by the black emptiness of the desert night. Melanie waited patiently, knowing I would find none.
This is crazy, you know, I told her, throwing the car into park and twisting the keys out of the ignition. The whole thing. There can't really be anyone out here. We won't find anything. And we're going to get hopelessly lost trying.
I had an abstract sense of the physical danger in what we were planning, wandering out into the heat with no backup plan, no way to return. I knew Melanie understood the danger far more clearly, but she held the specifics back. She didn't respond to my accusations. None of these problems bothered her. I could see that she'd rather wander alone in the desert for the rest of her life than go back to the life I'd had before. Even without the threat of the seeker, this was preferable to her. I leaned the seat back as far as it would go. It wasn't close to far enough for comfort. I doubted that I would be able to sleep, but there were so many things I wasn't allowing myself to think about that my mind was vacant and uninteresting. Melanie was silent, too. I closed my eyes, finding little difference between my lids and the moonless night, and drifted into unconsciousness with unexpected ease. Chapter 11. Dehydrated.
Okay, you were right, you were right, I said the words out loud. There was no one around to hear me. Melanie wasn't saying I told you so, not in so many words, but I could feel the accusation in her silence. I was still unwilling to leave the car, though it was useless to me now. When the gas ran out, I had let it roll forward with the remaining momentum until it took a nosedive into a shallow gorge, a thick rivulet cut by the last big rain. Now I stared out the windshield at the vast, vacant plain and felt my stomach twist with panic.
We have to move, Wanderer. It's only going to get hotter.
If I hadn't wasted more than a quarter of a tank of gas stubbornly pushing on to the very base of the second landmark, only to find that the third milestone was no longer visible from that vantage, and to have to turn around and backtrack, we would have been so much farther down this sandy wash, so much closer to our next goal. Thanks to me, we were going to have to travel on foot now. I loaded the water, one bottle at a time, into the pack, my motions unnecessarily deliberate. I added the remaining granola bars just as slowly. All the while, Melanie ached for me to hurry. Her impatience made it hard to think, hard to concentrate on anything, like what was going to happen to us.
Come on, come on, come on, she chanted, until I lurched stiff and awkward out of the car.
My back throbbed as I straightened up,
It hurt from sleeping so contorted last night, not from the weight of the pack. The pack wasn't that heavy when I used my shoulders to lift it. "Now cover the car," she instructed, picturing me ripping thorny branches from the nearby creosotes and palo verdes and draping them over the silver top of the car. "Why?" Her tone implied that I was quite stupid for not understanding. "So no one finds us." "But what if I want to be found? What if there's nothing out here but heat and dirt? We have no way to get home." "Home?" she questioned, throwing cheerless images at me. The vacant apartment in San Diego, the seeker's most obnoxious expression, the dot that marked Tucson on the map, a brief, happier flash of the red canyon that slipped in by accident. "Where would that be?" I turned my back on the car, ignoring her advice. I was in too far already. I wasn't going to give up all hope of return. Maybe someone would find the car and then find me. I could easily and honestly explain what I was doing here to any rescuer. I was lost. I'd lost my way. Lost my control. Lost my mind. I followed the wash at first, letting my body fall into its natural, long-strided rhythm. It wasn't the way I walked on the sidewalks to and from the university. It wasn't my walk at all. But it fit the rugged terrain here, and moved me smoothly forward with a speed that surprised me until I got used to it. What if I hadn't come this way, I wondered as I walked farther into the desert waste. What if Healer Fords were still in Chicago? What if my path hadn't taken us so close to them? It was that urgency, that lure, the thought that Jared and Jamie might be right here, somewhere in this empty place, that had made it impossible to resist this senseless plan. "I'm not sure," Melanie admitted. "I think I might still have tried, but I was afraid while the other souls were near. I'm still afraid. Trusting you could kill them both." We flinched together at the thought. "But being here, so close, it seemed like I had to try. Please." And suddenly she was pleading with me, begging me, no trace of resentment in her thoughts. "Please don't use this to hurt them. Please." "I don't want to. I don't know if I can hurt them. I'd rather..."
"What?"
"Die myself? Then give a few stray humans up to the Seekers?" Again we flinched at the thought, but my revulsion at the idea comforted her. And it frightened me more than it soothed her. When the wash started angling too far toward the north, Melanie suggested that we forget the flat, ashen path and take the direct line to the third landmark, the eastern spur of rock that seemed to point, finger-like, toward the cloudless sky. I didn't like leaving the wash, just as I'd resisted leaving the car. I could follow this wash all the way back to the road and the road back to the highway. It was miles and miles, and it would take me days to traverse. But once I stepped off this wash, I was officially adrift. "Have faith, wanderer. We'll find Uncle Jeb, or he'll find us. If he's still alive," I added, sighing and loping off my simple path into the brush that was identical in every direction. "Faith isn't a familiar concept for me. I don't know that I buy into it." "Trust, then? In who?" "You?" I laughed. The hot air baked my throat when I inhaled. "Just think," she said, changing the subject. "Maybe we'll see them by tonight." The yearning belonged to us both. The image of their faces, one man, one child, came from both memories. When I walked faster, I wasn't sure that I was completely in command of the motion. It did get hotter, and then hotter. And then hotter still. Sweat plastered my hair to my scalp and made my pale yellow t-shirt cling unpleasantly wherever it touched. In the afternoon, scorching gusts of wind kicked up, blowing sand in my face. The dry air sucked the sweat away, crusted my hair with grit, and fanned my shirt out from my body. It moved as stiffly as cardboard with the dried salt. I kept walking. I drank water more often than Melanie wanted me to. She begrudged me every mouthful, threatening me that we would want it much more tomorrow. But I'd already given her so much today that I was in no mood to listen. I drank when I was thirsty, which was most of the time. My legs moved me forward without any thought on my part. The crunching rhythm of my steps was background music, low and tedious. There was nothing to see. One twisted, brittle shrub looked exactly the same as the next. The empty homogeny lulled me into a sort of daze. I was only really aware of the shape of the mountain's silhouettes against the pale, bleached sky. I read their outlines every few steps, till I knew them so well I could have drawn them blindfolded. The view seemed frozen in place. I constantly whipped my head around, searching for the fourth marker, a big dome-shaped peak with a missing piece, a curved absence scooped from its side that Melanie had only shown me this morning, as if the perspective would have changed from my last step. I hoped this last clue was it, because we'd be lucky to get that far. But I had a sense that Melanie was keeping more from me, and our journey's end was impossibly distant. I snacked on my granola bars through the afternoon, not realizing until it was too late that I'd finished the last one. When the sun set, the night descended with the same speed as it had yesterday. Melanie was prepared, already scouting out a place to stop. "Here," she told me. "We'll want to stay as far from the Chola as possible. You toss in your sleep." I eyed the fluffy-looking cactus in the failing light, so thick with bone-colored needles that it resembled fur, and shuddered. "You want me to just sleep on the ground? Right here?" "You see another option?" She felt my panic, and her tone softened as if with pity. "Look, it's better than the car. At least it's flat. It's too hot for any critters to be attracted to your body heat, and..."
"Critters?"
I demanded aloud.
"Critters?"
There were brief, very unpleasant flashes of deadly-looking insects and coiled serpents in her memories.
"Don't worry,"
she tried to soothe me as I arched up on my tiptoes, away from anything that might be hiding in the sand below, my eyes searching the blackness for some escape. "Nothing's going to bother you unless you bother it first. After all, you're bigger than anything else out here." Another flash of memory, this time a medium-sized canine scavenger, a coyote, flitted through our thoughts. "Perfect," I moaned, sinking down into a crouch, though I was still afraid of the black ground beneath me. "Killed by wild dogs. Who would have thought it would end so trivially? How anticlimactic. The claw beast on the mists planet, sure. At least there'd be some dignity in being taken down by that." Melanie's answering tone made me picture her rolling her eyes. "Stop being a baby. Nothing is going to eat you. Now lie down and get some rest. Tomorrow will be harder than today."
"Thanks for the good news," I grumbled.
She was turning into a tyrant. It made me think of the human axiom, "Give him an inch and he'll take a mile." But I was more exhausted than I realized, and as I settled unwillingly to the ground, I found it impossible not to slump down on the rough, gravelly dirt and let my eyes close. It seemed like just minutes later when the morning dawned, blindingly bright and already hot enough to have me sweating. I was crusted in dirt and rocks when I woke. My right arm was pinned under me and had lost feeling. I shook out the tingles and then reached into my pack for some water. Melanie did not approve, but I ignored her. I looked for the half-empty bottle I'd last drunk from, rummaging through the fulls and empties until I began to see a pattern. With a slowly growing sense of alarm, I started counting. I counted twice. There were two more empties than there were fulls. I'd already used up more than half my water supply.
"I told you that you were drinking too much."
I didn't answer her, but I pulled the pack on without taking a drink. My mouth felt horrible, dry and sandy and tasting of bile. I tried to ignore that, tried to stop running my sandpaper tongue over my gritty teeth, and started walking. My stomach was harder to ignore than my mouth as the sun rose higher and hotter above me. It twisted and contracted at regular intervals, anticipating meals that didn't appear. By afternoon, the hunger had gone from uncomfortable to painful. "This is nothing," Melanie reminded me wryly. "We've been hungrier." "You have," I retorted. I didn't feel like being an audience to her endurance memories right now. I was beginning to despair when the good news came. As I swung my head across the horizon with a routine, half-hearted movement, the bulbous shape of the dome jumped out at me from the middle of a northern line of small peaks. The missing part was only a faint indentation from this vantage point. "Close enough," Melanie decided, as thrilled as I was to be making some progress. I turned north eagerly, my steps lengthening. "Keep a lookout for the next." She remembered another formation for me, and I started craning my head around it once, though I knew it was useless to search for it this early. It would be to the east. North and then east and then north again. That was the pattern. The lift of finding another milestone kept me moving despite the growing weariness in my legs. Melanie urged me on, chanting encouragements when I slowed, thinking of Jared and Jamie when I turned apathetic. My progress was steady, and I waited till Melanie okayed each drink, even though the inside of my throat felt as though it was blistering. I had to admit that I was proud of myself for being so tough. When the dirt road appeared, it seemed like a reward. It snaked toward the north, the direction I was already headed, but Melanie was skittish. "I don't like the look of it," she insisted. The road was just a sallow line through the scrub, defined only by its smoother texture and lack of vegetation. Ancient tire tracks made a double depression, centered in the single lane. "When it goes the wrong way, we'll leave it." I was already walking down the middle of the tracks. "It's easier than weaving through the creosote and watching out for Chawla." She didn't answer, but her unease made me feel a little paranoid. I kept up my search for the next formation, a perfect M, two matching volcanic points, but I also watched the desert around me more carefully than before. Because I was paying extra attention, I noticed the gray smudge in the distance long before I could make out what it was. I wondered if my eyes were playing tricks on me, and blinked against the dust that clouded them. The color seemed wrong for a rock, and the shape too solid for a tree. I squinted into the brightness, making guesses. Then I blinked again, and the smudge suddenly jumped into a structured shape, closer than I'd been thinking. It was some kind of house or building, small and weathered to a dull gray. Melanie's spike of panic had me dancing off the narrow lane and into the dubious cover of the barren brush. "Hold on," I told her. "I'm sure it's abandoned."
"How do you know?"
She was holding back so hard that I had to concentrate on my feet before I could move them forward.
"Who would live out here? We souls live for society."
I heard the bitter edge to my explanation, and knew it was because of where I now stood, physically and metaphorically in the middle of nowhere. Why did I no longer belong to the society of souls? Why did I feel like I didn't want to belong? Had I ever really been a part of the community that was meant to be my own? Or was that the reason behind my long line of lives lived in transience? Had I always been an aberration, or was this something Melanie was making me into? Had this planet changed me, or revealed me for what I already was? Melanie had no patience for my personal crisis. She wanted me to get far away from that building as fast as possible. Her thoughts yanked and twisted at mine, pulling me out of my introspection. "Calm down," I ordered, trying to focus my thoughts to separate them from hers. "If there is anything that actually lives here, it would be human. Trust me on this. There is no such thing as a hermit among souls. Maybe your Uncle Jeb... She rejected that thought harshly. No one could survive out in the open like this. Your kind would have searched any habitation thoroughly. Whoever lived here ran or became one of you. Uncle Jeb would have a better hiding place.
And if whoever lived here became one of us, I assured her, then they left this place. Only a human would live this way.
I trailed off, suddenly afraid, too.
What?
She reacted strongly to my fright, freezing us in place. She scanned my thoughts, looking for something I'd seen to upset me. But I'd seen nothing new.
Melanie, what if there are humans out here? Not Uncle Jeb and Jared and Jamie. What if someone else found us?
She absorbed the idea slowly, thinking it through.
You're right. They'd kill us immediately.
Of course. I tried to swallow, to wash the taste of terror from my dry mouth.
There won't be anyone else.
How could there be? She reasoned. Your kind are far too thorough. Only someone already in hiding would have a chance. So let's go check it out. You're sure there are none of you, and I'm sure there are none of me. Maybe we can find something helpful, something we can use as a weapon.
I shuddered at her thoughts of sharp knives and long metal tools that could be turned to clubs. No weapons.
Ugh. How did such spineless creatures beat us?
Stealth and superior numbers. Any one of you, even your young, is 100 times as dangerous as one of us. But you're like one termite in an anthill. There are millions of us, all working together in perfect harmony toward our goal. Again, as I described the unity, I felt the dragging sense of panic and disorientation. Who was I?
We kept to the creosote as we approached the little structure. It looked to be a house, just a small shack beside the road, with no hint at all of any other purpose. The reason for its location here was a mystery. This spot had nothing to offer but emptiness and heat. There was no sign of recent habitation. The doorframe gaped, doorless, and only a few shards of glass clung to the empty window frames. Dust gathered on the threshold and spilled inside. The gray, weathered walls seemed to lean away from the wind, as if it always blew from the same direction here. I was able to contain my anxiety as I walked hesitantly to the vacant doorframe. We must be just as alone here as we had been all day and all yesterday. The shade the dark entry promised drew me forward, trumping my fears with its appeal. I still listened intently, but my feet moved ahead with quick, sure steps. I darted through the doorway, moving quickly to one side so as to have a wall at my back. This was instinctual, a product of Melanie's scavenging days. I stood frozen there, unnerved by my blindness, waiting for my eyes to adjust. The little shack was empty as we'd known it would be. There were no more signs of occupation inside than out. A broken table slanted down from its 2 good legs in the middle of the room, with 1 rusted metal chair beside it. Patches of concrete showed through big holes in the worn, grimy carpet. A kitchenette lined the wall with a rusted sink, a row of cabinets, some doorless, and a waist-high refrigerator that hung open, revealing its moldy black insides. A couch frame sat against the far wall, all the cushions gone. Still mounted above the couch, only a little crooked, was a framed print of dogs playing poker.
Homie, Melanie thought, relieved enough to be sarcastic. It's got more decor than your apartment.
I was already moving for the sink.
Dream on, Melanie added helpfully.
Of course it would be wasteful to have water running to this secluded place. The souls manage details like that better than to leave such an anomaly behind. I still had to twist the ancient knobs. 1 broke off in my hand, rusted through. I turned to the cupboards next, kneeling on the nasty carpet to peek carefully inside. I leaned away as I opened the door, afraid I might be disturbing one of the venomous desert animals in its lair. The first was empty, backless, so that I could see the wooden slats of the outside wall. The next had no door, but there was a stack of antique newspapers inside, covered with dust. I pulled one out, curious, shaking the dirt to the dirtier floor, and read the date. "From human times," I noted. Not that I needed a date to tell me that. "Man burns three-year-old daughter to death," the headline screamed at me, accompanied by a picture of an angelic blonde child. This wasn't the front page. The horror detailed here was not so hideous as to rate priority coverage. Beneath this was the face of a man wanted for the murders of his wife and two children 2 years before the print date. The story was about a possible sighting of the man in Mexico. Two people killed and three injured in a drunk driving accident. A fraud and murder investigation into the alleged suicide of a prominent local banker. A suppressed confession setting an admitted child molester free. House pets found slaughtered in a trash bin. I cringed, shoving the paper away from me back into the dark cupboard. Those were the exceptions, not the norm, Melanie thought quietly, trying to keep the fresh horror of my reaction from seeping into her memories of those years and recoloring them. Can you see how we thought we might be able to do better, though? How we could have supposed that maybe you didn't deserve all the excellent things of this world? Her answer was acidic. If you wanted to cleanse the planet, you could have blown it up. Despite what your science fiction writers dream, we simply don't have the technology. She didn't think my joke was funny. Besides, I added, that would have been such a waste. It's a lovely planet. This unspeakable desert excepted, of course. That's how we realized you were here, you know, she said, thinking of the sickening news headlines again. When the evening news was nothing but inspiring human interest stories, when pedophiles and junkies were lining up at the hospitals to turn themselves in, when everything morphed into Mayberry, that's when you tipped your hand. What an awful alteration, I said dryly, turning to the next cupboard. I pulled the stiff door back and found the mother load. Crackers, I shouted, seizing the discolored half-smashed box of saltines. There was another box behind it, one that looked like someone had stepped on it. Twinkies, I crowed. Look, Melanie urged, pointing a mental finger at three dusty bottles of bleach at the very back of the cupboard. What do you want bleach for? I asked, already ripping into the cracker box. To throw in someone's eyes, or to brain them with the bottle? To my delight, the crackers, though reduced to crumbs, were still inside their plastic sleeves. I tore one open and started shaking the crumbs into my mouth, swallowing them half-chewed. I couldn't get them into my stomach fast enough. Open a bottle and smell it, she instructed, ignoring my commentary. That's how my dad used to store water in the garage. The bleach residue kept the water from growing anything. In a minute. I finished one sleeve of crumbs and started on the next. They were very stale, but compared to the taste in my mouth, they were ambrosia. When I finished the third, I became aware that the salt was burning the cracks in my lips and at the corners of my mouth. I heaved out one of the bleach bottles, hoping Melanie was right. My arms felt weak and noodly, barely able to lift it. This concerned us both. How much had our condition deteriorated already? How much farther would we be able to go? The bottle's cap was so tight, I wondered if it had melted into place. Finally, though, I was able to twist it off with my teeth. I sniffed at the opening carefully, not especially wanting to pass out from bleach fumes. The chemical scent was very faint. I sniffed deeper. It was water, definitely. Stagnant, musty water, but water all the same. I took a small mouthful. not a fresh mountain stream, but wet. I started guzzling.
Easy there, Melanie warned me, and I had to agree. We'd lucked into this cash, but it made no sense to squander it. Besides, I wanted something solid now that the salt burn had eased. I turned to the box of Twinkies and licked three of the smushed-up cakes from the inside of the wrappers. The last cupboard was empty. As soon as the hunger pangs had eased slightly, Melanie's impatience began to leak into my thoughts. Feeling no resistance this time, I quickly loaded my spoils into my pack, pitching the empty water bottles into the sink to make room. The bleach jugs were heavy, but theirs was a comforting weight. It meant I wouldn't stretch out to sleep on the desert floor, thirsty and hungry again tonight. With the sugar energy beginning to buzz through my veins, I loped back out into the bright afternoon. Chapter 12. Failed.
It's impossible. You've got it wrong. Out of order. That can't be it.
I stared into the distance, sick with disbelief that was turning quickly to horror. Yesterday morning I'd eaten the last mangled Twinkie for breakfast. Yesterday afternoon I'd found the double peak and turned east again. Melanie had given me what she promised was the last formation to find. The news had made me nearly hysterical with joy. Last night I'd drunk the last of the water. That was day 4. This morning was a hazy memory of blinding sun and desperate hope. Time was running out, and I'd searched the skyline for the last milestone with a growing sense of panic. I couldn't see any place where it could fit. The long, flat line of a mesa flanked by blunt peaks on either end like sentinels. Such a thing would take space, and the mountains to the east and north were thick with toothy points. I couldn't see where the flat mesa could be hiding between them. Mid-morning, the sun was still in the east in my eyes. I'd stopped to rest. I'd felt so weak that it frightened me. Every muscle in my body had begun to ache, but it was not from all the walking. I could feel the ache of exertion and also the ache from sleeping on the ground, and these were different from the new ache. My body was drying out, and this ache was my muscles protesting the torture of it. I knew that I couldn't keep going much longer. I'd turned my back on the east to get the sun off my face for a moment. That's when I'd seen it. The long, flat line of the mesa, unmistakable with the bordering peaks. There it was, so far away in the distant west that it seemed to shimmer above a mirage, floating, hovering over the desert like a dark cloud. Every step we'd walked had been in the wrong direction. The last marker was farther to the west than we'd come in all our journeying.
Impossible, I whispered again.
Melanie was frozen in my head, unthinking, blank, trying desperately to reject this new comprehension. I waited for her, my eyes tracing the undeniably familiar shapes until the sudden weight of her acceptance and grief knocked me to my knees. Her silent keen of defeat echoed in my head and added one more layer to the pain. My breathing turned ragged, a soundless, tearless sobbing. The sun crept up my back, its heat soaked deep into the darkness of my hair. My shadow was a small circle beneath me when I regained control. Painstakingly, I got back on my feet. Tiny sharp rocks were embedded in the skin on my legs. I didn't bother to brush these off. I stared at the floating mesa mocking me from the west for a long, hot time. And finally, not really sure why I did it, I started walking forward. I knew only this, that it was me who moved, and no one else. Melanie was so small in my brain, a tiny capsule of pain wrapped tightly in on herself. There was no help from her. My footsteps were a slow crunch, crunch across the brittle ground. He was just a deluded old lunatic after all,
I murmured to myself. A strange shudder rocked my chest, and a hoarse coughing ripped its way up my throat. The stream of gravelly coughs rattled on, but it wasn't until I felt my eyes pricking for tears that couldn't come that I realized I was laughing.
There was never, ever anything out here,
I gasped between spasms of hysteria. I staggered forward as though I were drunk, my footprints trailing unevenly behind me.
No!
Melanie uncurled from her misery to defend the faith she still clung to. I got it wrong or something. My fault. I laughed at her now. The sound was sucked away by the scorching wind. Wait, wait, she thought, trying to pull my attention away from the joke of it all. You don't think... I mean, do you think that maybe they tried this? Her unexpected fear caught me mid-laugh. I choked on the hot air, my chest throbbing from my fit of morbid hysteria. By the time I could breathe again, all trace of my black humor was gone. Instinctively, my eyes swept the desert void, looking for some evidence that I was not the first to waste my life this way. The plain was impossibly vast, but I couldn't halt my frantic search for remains. No, of course not. Melanie was already comforting herself. Jared's too smart. He would never come out here unprepared like we did. He'd never put Jamie in danger.
I'm sure you're right, I told her,
wanting to believe it as much as she did. I'm sure no one else in the whole universe could be this stupid. Besides, he probably never came to look. He probably never figured it out. Wish you hadn't. My feet kept moving. I was barely aware of the action. It meant so little in the face of the distance ahead. And even if we were magically transported to the very base of the mesa, what then? I was absolutely positive there was nothing there. No one waited at the mesa to save us. We're going to die, I said. I was surprised that there was no fear in my rasping voice. This was just a fact, like any other. The sun is hot. The desert is dry. We are going to die. Yes. She was calm, too. This death was easier to accept than that our efforts had been guided by insanity. That doesn't bother you? She thought for a moment before answering. At least I died trying. And I won. I never gave them away. I never hurt them. I did my best to find them. I tried to keep my promise. I die for them. I counted 19 steps before I could respond. 19 sluggish, futile crunches across the sand. Then what am I dying for? I wondered, the pricking feeling returning in my desiccated tear ducts. I guess it's because I lost, then, right? Is that why? I counted 34 crunches before she had an answer to my question. No, she thought slowly. It doesn't feel that way to me. I think that maybe you're dying to be human. There was almost a smile in her thought as she heard the silly double meaning to the phrase. After all the planets and all the hosts you've left behind, you finally found the place and the body you'd die for. I think you've found your home, Wanderer. 10 crunches. I didn't have the energy to open my lips anymore. Too bad I didn't get to stay here longer then. I wasn't sure about her answer. Maybe she was trying to make me feel better. A sop for dragging her out here to die. She had won. She had never disappeared. My steps began to falter. My muscles screamed out to me for mercy, as if I had any means to soothe them. I think I would have stopped right there, but Melanie was, as always, tougher than I. I could feel her now, not just in my head but in my limbs. My stride lengthened. The path I made was straighter. By sheer force of will, she dragged my half-dead carcass toward the impossible goal. There was an unexpected joy to the pointless struggle. Just as I could feel her, she could feel my body. Our body now. My weakness ceded control to her. She gloried in the freedom of moving our arms and legs forward, no matter how useless such a motion was. It was bliss, simply because she could again. Even the pain of the slow death we had begun dimmed in comparison. "What do you think is out there?" she asked me as we marched on toward the end. "What will you see after we're dead?" "Nothing." The word was empty and hard and sure. "There's a reason we call it the final death." "The souls have no belief in an afterlife?" "We have so many lives. Anything more would be too much to expect. We die a little death every time we leave a host. We live again in another. When I die here, that would be the end." There was a long pause while our feet moved more and more slowly. "What about you?" I finally asked. "Do you still believe in something more, even after all of this?" My thoughts raked over her memories of the end of the human world. "It seems like there are some things that can't die." In our mind, their faces were close and clear. The love we felt for Jared and Jamie did feel very permanent. In that moment, I wondered if death was strong enough to dissolve something so vital and sharp. Perhaps this love would live on with her in some fairy tale place with pearly gates. Not with me. Would it be a relief to be free of it? I wasn't sure. It felt like it was part of who I was now. We only lasted a few hours. Even Melanie's tremendous strength of mind could ask no more than that of our failing body. We could barely see. We couldn't seem to find the oxygen in the dry air we sucked in and spit back out. The pain brought rough whimpers breaking through our lips. "You've never had it this bad," I teased her feebly, as we staggered toward a dried stick of a tree standing a few feet taller than the low brush. We wanted to get to the thin streaks of shade before we fell. "No," she agreed. "Never this bad." We attained our purpose. The dead tree threw its cobwebby shadow over us, and our legs fell out from under us. We sprawled forward, never wanting the sun on our face again. Our head turned to the side on its own, searching for the burning air. We stared at the dust inches from our nose and listened to the gasping of our breath. After a time, long or short, we didn't know, we closed our eyes. Our lids were red and bright inside. We couldn't feel the faint web of shade. Maybe it no longer touched us. "How long?" I asked her. "I don't know. I've never died before." "An hour? More?" "Your guess is as good as mine."
"Where's a coyote when you really need one?"
"Maybe we'll get lucky. Escaped claw beast or something." Her thought trailed off incoherently. That was our last conversation. It was too hard to concentrate enough to form words. There was more pain than we thought there should be. All the muscles in our body rioted, cramping and spasming as they fought death. We didn't fight. We drifted and waited, our thoughts dipping in and out of memories without a pattern. While it was still lucid, we hummed ourselves a lullaby in our head. It was the one we'd used to comfort Jamie when the ground was too hard or the air was too cold or the fear was too great to sleep. We felt his head press into the hollow just below our shoulder and the shape of his back under our arm.
and then it seemed that it was our head cradled against a broader shoulder, and a new lullaby comforted us. Our lids turned black, but not with death. Night had fallen, and this made us sad. Without the heat of day, we would probably last longer. It was dark and silent for a timeless space. Then there was a sound. It barely roused us. We weren't sure if we imagined it. Maybe it was a coyote after all. Did we want that? We didn't know. We lost our train of thought and forgot the sound. Something shook us, pulled our numb arms, dragged at them. We couldn't form the words to wish that it would be quick now, but that was our hope. We waited for the cut of teeth. Instead, the dragging turned to pushing, and we felt our face roll toward the sky. It poured over our face, wet, cool, and impossible. It dribbled over our eyes,